They've watched Citizen Kane a combined 200 times. Elliot's first words were, "I personally thought the use of Dutch angles was derivative in the 400 blows." In Nathan's favorite historical figure is Fritz Lang. Now they're bringing that snootiness to you with Magellan's at the Movies.
Welcome back, listening audience, to Magellan's at the Movies. I'm your host, Nathan Mogulyans, joined by my co-host, co-anchor, co-air, Elliot Mogulyans. Elliot, the big news of today and the big news of this week was the Oscar nominations were revealed this morning. Some of our thoughts on some of these nominations should be evident if you've been listening, if you've been keeping up with the podcast. We've made some of our thoughts on some of these movies known. But Elliot, what are your thoughts on the nominations? Do you think the Academy got it right this year? Do you think they're way off the mark? Is there anything that you were excited to see? Anything you were bummed to see? What are your reactions?
Dude. I've been trying for the last few years to watch all of the nominations for Best Picture, and it's like this list was specifically designed to test my commitment to that. Best Picture, if you didn't know, here's the list. Anora, The Brutalist, A Complete Unknown, Conclave, Dune Part 2, Emilia Perez, I'm Still Here, Nickel Boys, The Substance, and Wicked. I have seen three of those.
Oof.
And my interest in the rest is, I would say, medium to non-existent.
Well, I think that's a little hard. I mean, you know, your excitement level is your excitement level. I've seen 6 of the 10. And I am genuinely interested in seeing Nickel Boys and The Brutalist, as well as I'm mildly interested in Anora and I'm Still Here. I mean, I've already said on this podcast that my thoughts on Emilia Perez, and I'm not breaking, like, if you go anywhere on the internet today, everyone is bashing this movie, so I don't need to relitigate that. I do think it's neat that I'm Still Here ended up with a nomination. I didn't see any predictions to that effect leading up to it. So I think that's kind of neat because it's a foreign movie. This is the first time 2 movies nominated for Best Foreign Film are also nominated for Best Picture. And yeah, I don't know. It's neat. I don't love The Substance, but I do think it's cool that a movie in that sort of genre is getting nominated. I think that's kind of exciting. So I don't think this list is great. Obviously, very few of my favorite movies from the year ended up on this list, but I don't think it's, like, atrocious. It's not an affront to humanity.
I don't know. I don't want to watch Wicked. I don't want to watch Emilia Perez.
I wouldn't. On it. It's not worth it. I know you would hate both of those movies, probably more than I do.
Yeah, but I want to be able to, you know. Oh, I said, you know. Dang it. Well, anyway, let's take a look at the rest of the nominations just for a bit. Best Director, any thoughts? Dune Part 2 directed itself, lol.
I hate that joke so much. I can't,
that's
like...
That's the best joke of all time.
It's so frustrating to me because it's like... It's such a lazy way. And look, I think I've said this before on this podcast. I personally don't think we should have a Best Director award. I think we should just give Best Picture to the director instead of to the producers, because the director had way more of a hand in making the movie what it was, at least in my opinion, than the producers did. The producers, I think giving the award to the producers is the fastest way to keep the Oscars being a question of money more than a question of art, which I don't think it's completely a question of money. I do think movies that are very good receive awards, but I do think as long as the people with the money are the people who stand to gain the most. So I think that. I think we should get rid of Best Director, give Best Picture to the director. I don't understand why we give it to the producers anyway. But yeah, Denis not being nominated is... I'm not happy about it. I don't see how you can watch Doom Part 2 and just how much movie there is in that movie and how much is going on and think that it wasn't a truly Herculean feat to direct it. But whatever.
Yeah, I did not listen to a single word of that because I've heard that speech many times before. I've just been perusing through these categories. Best visual effects, I mean, Dune Part 2, that's a lock. Especially against Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes? Come on. And Better Man? That monkey looks terrible.
Two monkey movies in the visual effects category, though.
Yeah, that's true. Which monkey do you think looks better? The monkey in Better Man or the monkeys in Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes?
I think the sandworm looks better than both of them.
I think that Kingdom looks better than Better Man, but no one's ever going to watch Better Man, so we'll never know for sure, really. Funny. Best production design, Dune Part 2, nice. Best costume design, why is Dune not in there? Come on.
I don't know. This is. It seems as though Wicked kind of took a lot of Dune's heat in some of the technical categories, as well as how on earth is Wicked eligible to be nominated for Best Score and Dune Part 2 wasn't? Like, surely huge chunks of the Wicked score are just the Wicked score. Like, I don't know, maybe because it's not a movie, it doesn't count as pre-existing material, but I don't know.
Hey, I'm Still Here is from Brazil.
It
Let's
is.
Let's go. Represent.
It is from Brazil. It's
actually, I was, again, while I was not listening to you, I was reading the plot of the movie. It's about the military dictatorship. That's why our grandparents left Brazil, was because of the military dictatorship.
Yeah.
Maybe they should make a movie about us and our family.
Yeah, that sounds really good, Elliot.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen a lot of these movies, so I'm more than open to watching The Substance and coming away thinking that it's the greatest thing ever made by human hands, including the pyramids and soup kitchens.
I don't know about that. I think the only other thing I'd like to highlight is Flo. Did end up getting a nomination for Best Foreign Film, which I think is really cool, and signals that it's very likely it's going to win Best Animated Film, given that that happens a lot if something is nominated in multiple categories that doesn't usually get nominated in multiple categories. A lot of the times they come away with stuff. So I think that would be really cool, especially since it seems like Flo was... One dude did like 90% of the work on Flo. The credits of Flo have the same guy show up like 18 times. So I'm very excited if it wins to be able to see the director and animator and writer and blah and blah and blah go up and talk about it.
It's like in indie games when one person makes the whole thing. Like Balatro. That was made by one person, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, we should move on because it's 9 o'clock at night. I'm an old man. I need my sleep. Nathan, you chose the movie this week, so why don't you introduce the audience if they aren't already acquainted with There Would Be Blood, and if you would be so kind as to favor us with a plot summary.
Yeah, absolutely. Before I do that, I do have to really quick add on one thing.
Oh my gosh.
That I just would like to say, you know, rest in peace to David Lynch, the legendary director who passed away, I think it was last was it last Tuesday or was it on this Tuesday? I don't, time moves weirdly for me. But yeah, he's beloved by a lot of people. I've never been a huge David Lynch fan. I think it's very likely in the coming weeks. I know, what a way to start a commentary on him. I think it's really likely in the coming weeks we're going to do a David Lynch movie. Just there's no better time to do it. So we'll talk about him some more in that episode. But I do think it's a real, regardless of my feelings on his movies, I think 100% David Lynch is someone who saw what cinema could be and really loved cinema and understood it in a way that not every director does, which I think is, it's always unfortunate when we lose people like that, because there's not, you know, not everyone in the industry is like that. So anyway, There Will Be Blood is a 2007 movie directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. I'd say it's probably the most well-known Paul Thomas Anderson movie. He's a fairly popular director. I'd say he's in a similar vein to he hasn't achieved as much commercial success as Christopher Nolan, but he came out around a similar time as Christopher Nolan. He's an early noughties director, very well known for just really interesting, really meticulously constructed movies in a variety of different styles and places. He's done movies that are period pieces. He's done stuff that are set in the modern day. He's done romance. He's done action. He's done a little bit of everything. And I cited Boogie Nights, his movies from the 90s, as one of my favorite movies from the 90s. And so I thought, what better excuse is there than this to talk about probably his most famous movie and talk about the director as a whole. So There Will Be Blood follows Daniel Plainview during the turn of the century, from the 1800s to the 1900s, as this Mr. Plainview tries to, by any means necessary, get rich off of the oil boom that is taking place in the American West. And so the movie follows him as he learns about this town that has quite a bit of oil, and he tries to ingratiate himself into the town. He comes up against the town's pastor, Eli Sunday, who is very fervently religious, and Daniel Plainview is very fervently greedy, and so these two things are not not conducive.
Oh, I don't know, Nathan.
Well, see, that's one of the things the movie is about. But this movie was very successful. It was nominated for Best Picture. It was nominated for a whole host of other things. I believe it only won Best Cinematography, and then the second Best Acting win for Daniel Day-Lewis, who's, I think, probably one of the more famous method actors, more famous, very successful actors out there. This movie was nominated against Elliot's favorite movie, No Country for Old Men. It's commonly talked about in a lot of circles of, oh, which one deserved to win, No Country or There Will Be Blood. It's considered one of the best movies of the noughties. My own experience with this movie is I watched it way back in like high school, and I think I didn't really understand it. I thought it was boring, and I was very interested to revisit it, see if those feelings stick around now that I've seen almost all of Paul Thomas Anderson's other movies, if that changes my feelings towards it. So I'm pretty excited for this episode. Elliot, you know, why don't you talk about your experience with this movie? Because I seem to remember that you had seen this before me, and that like we watched this for the first time for me together because you had enjoyed it and we're like, oh, let's watch this.
What? I have no memory of that.
Oh, well, maybe I'm just making up stuff.
I don't know. Like I said, I'm tired. Dude, I'm an old man. I need my sleep.
So cool.
But yeah, I've only seen this movie a few times. But I always maintained that I liked it. I'm not even the biggest PTA fan. He's very hit or miss for me. If you'll cast your mind back, I recommended this movie for Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
Because they're both about industrialists. Daniel Plainview is kind of like Mr. Potter from It's a Wonderful Life if he had to be charismatic.
That's a really good comparison, yeah.
He has the same outlook, if not the same approach.
Yeah.
That doesn't matter. Literally no one cares. All that is to say that I love this movie. I thought it was fantastic. Wow. If anything, I think I maybe enjoyed it a little bit more than I have historically on this rewatch. I thought it was a great character study. I loved the acting. There's not a whole lot for me to say. And also, again, I'm tired, so it's going to be hard for me to articulate myself. But Daniel Day-Lewis, no one needs to be told that he's a good actor, but he is. And I think that for the longest time, I was disappointed by the conflict between Plainview and Sunday, because I wanted something a little bit more, something a little bit more like equals, right? Meeting on the field of battle. But Eli Sunday is just kind of a whiny, screechy little twerp. And I think that this time around, I was really able to see the different ways that they mirror each other and the ways that it's not really about their conflict as much as it is about how Eli Sunday reflects on Plainview. Like, this is definitely Plainview's movie. It's not really about that central conflict. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. Nathan, what did you think of the movie?
I think I enjoyed it more than I did on its first time. And I'm excited to talk. I'm glad that you like this movie, because I do think this is a movie that I can, and I feel this way about all of the PTA movies, even the ones I don't really like, that I can see that there's a vision there, that there's a clear idea that the director is trying to present to me. I think my issue with There Will Be Blood is I kind of struggle to see why I should care about the vision, or sometimes I struggle to get very invested in it. I agree, this is very much a movie about Daniel Plainview, and yeah, I don't know how much we need to talk about the acting, because, like, calling Daniel Day-Lewis a talented actor is like, you know, calling James Cameron movies successful. That's evident by, you know, anyone who has a brain, that clearly that's true. I guess you can disagree and you're not brainless. Let me walk that back a little bit.
By the way, you forgot to mention, and maybe you didn't even know, that this movie is loosely, very, very loosely, based on Oil by Upton Sinclair.
I did know that. I didn't. It's so loose that it's kind of an irrelevant detail. Although I did note that I was like, oh, sick, it's Upton Sinclair. That's Upton Sinclair as played by Bill Nye in Mank.
Yeah. Anyway. Go ahead.
Anyway. Yeah. The acting in this movie is fantastic. I just think sometimes I don't find Daniel Plainview to be an interesting enough character for me to want to spend nearly 3 hours watching him do things. And so I think maybe we should start there, that this movie is clearly about Daniel Plainview, about his, the way he sees the world, about how he sees what he needs to do in order to succeed, his drive to succeed. So maybe let's just start there at, you know, Daniel Plainview, the character, the person. I've seen a lot of people compare this movie to Citizen Kane in terms of a very American figure reflecting back American ideals and kind of the negatives of some of those ideals. So, you know, do you see that in the movie? Is that where you're finding Plainview as a very interesting character to be studied?
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that. In these kinds of situations, I'm always thinking, like, a lot of different people. If you ask 10 different people to define American ideals, you're going to come away with 10 different answers. So I feel like those kinds of questions aren't really profitable to pursue. There, I'm speaking in Daniel Plainview's language, profits. I think that he is interesting for how he views and uses and exploits people. And I won't lie, I think that a lot of this is down to the skill and just the entertainingness of Daniel Day-Lewis's performance. But I think that his, like, barely constrained malevolence, his deep-seated burning misanthropy, I think it's really, it's just really cool to watch how he kind of loses a hold of that. Like, as the movie goes on, I think that he, the way he deals with people becomes noticeably more brusque. Like, when he goes out to this, there's this, like, one lone holdout who hasn't sold Daniel, who hasn't sold his land to Plainview. And Plainview goes out to, pretty late in the movie, goes out to this person's house, and he's very blunt and direct with the person who he meets there. And compared with the opening and the earlier sections of the movie, when he is, excuse me, he is wheeling and dealing and feeding people lines about the good Lord and community and the need for people to help other people and stuff that he clearly doesn't believe, the difference is night and day. And so I think it's really interesting just to see why that happens, why he becomes ever more belligerent, to the point where he drives away the one person about which he could possibly, ostensibly, be described as caring about, his adopted son, H.W. Although, even there, I think there are a lot of really great moments where his priorities are revealed. Like when his son gets injured in an explosion that lights a oil spout on fire, and he leaves his son to take care of business first. And even when it's under control, I think he doesn't go back to his son. So I just find that kind of like Shakespearean tragic dark character who's continually corrupted by power, I just find that kind of arc inherently interesting.
I also find that arc interesting. I think some of my issue with the movie comes from it feels less like an arc to me and more like continually beating the same drum. That it kind of feels to me like there's maybe he's a little brusquer and meaner as the movie continues, but I also kind of feel like the movie shows a lot of the qualities of Daniel Plainview early in the movie and then just continue showing those same qualities. That, like, it clearly shows that he's adopted HW solely for the purpose of, like, looking like a family man and, like, gaining sympathy from people for being a widower and stuff. And he does that, like, in the third scene of the movie. So for the rest of the movie, when he keeps, right, mistreating HW and not really treating him very well, it feels to me like double beats. That it's like, yeah, I get it, he's using his son for profit, like, he doesn't actually care about him. That checks out to me. I got that the first time they showed him. And again, it's not, I think you really did touch on something very good, though, that even when the movie is not interesting, it's very, very entertaining. And that is Daniel Day-Lewis's performance is great. I loved every time Eli would show up that you could see just like a light go out behind Daniel Plainview's eyes where he's like, oh gosh, I gotta deal with this stupid crackpot again. And just like the barely disguised, yeah, like you said, malevolent, like malice for everyone. That he's just like barely keeping in the fact that he hates every other human being because they are taking up things that he wants to have. That he wants to have all the money and all the oil and all the stuff. And that's very entertaining to watch. I think the thing that keeps the movie from being the masterpiece that so many other people characterize it as is the fact that I find it entertaining. I don't necessarily find it particularly interesting. I think it's a lot of the same beats where, and, you know, maybe this is just me, but I see a lot of people saying, like, oh, the movie says a lot about, like, capitalism or American society. I'm like, really? Because I think Plainview is just kind of a sociopath. Like, you know, I don't know how much it says about society if the person at the center of the story doesn't feel like a realistic human. Not that he's unrealistic, but it's just like, I think he's evil in a way that not every person is evil. So I don't know if he really becomes something that to me feels like he's saying something about greater society or people in general, because it feels like he's a bit of an edge case. Maybe that's just me, though.
Well, I think that as far as that area of the film goes, it helps if you are already predisposed to characterize or believe industrialists or just the very rich to be that. You just like fold Plainview into that cast, and I'm not even saying that that's necessarily wrong. I mean, the accumulation of great wealth probably does things psychologically to people that are not healthy, and don't manifest themselves in healthy ways, but I don't think that that's necessarily what this movie is about. If I could just circle back for a minute, I think that he does care about his son. I think that there is, that is in evidence at the times, like when he's laying down with his son and just hugging him while his son is trying to hear his own voice again. And I think when he sends his son to a deaf school in San Francisco and he tricks him, he says, like, they're on a train, and he says to HW, I'm going to go do something else. And in reality, he gets off the train. I think that there is clear emotion on Plainview's face at that point, that this is hurting him to hurt his son. I think that the problem is that he cares about other things more. Mm-hmm. And that's borne out in the moments like when he leaves his son during the calamity at the oil spout, and of course at the end when his son is trying to be his own person and possibly compete with him, Plainview's almost Ahab-like obsession with success at the expense of others because of his inborn or ingrained misanthropy, he just can't tolerate that.
Yeah. Well, and I agree with this, that I think the most interesting parts of the Daniel Plainview character are the scenes, like the scenes that you just mentioned, or the scene after he kills the man who's been posing as his brother. He breaks down crying, and I think it's a really interesting scene, and these other scenes that you're talking about are fascinating to me because they represent a crack in that exterior, that he's upset that this guy wasn't his brother. Like, he's upset that he's lost someone that he felt like he could talk to. I think it's really telling that within, like, a day of knowing this guy who's claiming to be his brother, he's sitting on the porch with him and he's bearing, like, his soul. He's telling him exactly, like, hey, I hate everyone. I want everything. Like, he's spilling his guts to this guy. And I think it's really, I think he is really torn up about the fact that this didn't turn into something. But again, he's got these drives to compete. He's got these drives to dislike people. He's got these drives to shore up his own image that won't let him say, hey, you've been faking being my brother. That's fine. Like, you know, now you can just be you and we can just be buddies. No, he has to kill him. And so I think those are the moments that are really interesting. The issue is they're kind of few and far between. And again, this movie is like nearly 3 hours long, and we spend most of it, this is maybe to move the conversation away from just Plainview, we spend most of it with Plainview in juxtaposition with Paul Dano's Eli Sunday. Also, I will say, I am terrible at watching movies because it was like near the end of the movie when I finally like put the dots together that Eli and Paul were different people and that Paul Dano was playing twins. Because like at the beginning of the movie, I was like, this is bizarre. Why is Paul Dano not saying like, hey, I know why you're here. Like, I know the jig is up, dude. I know exactly what game you're playing at. And when characters kept calling him like Eli and then saying something about Paul, I was like, what? Is his middle name Paul? And some people call him his... I was really confused. So maybe, you know, take my opinion with a grain of salt because I don't watch every movie paying the closest attention. But I think Paul Dano, firstly, again, the acting, fantastic. Paul Dano is doing an incredible job. He's more than holding his own, in my opinion. But we spend most of the movie in juxtaposition of these two men who both seem to be using an image or an ideal in service of, like, accumulating things for themselves. In Plainview's case, it's accumulating actual money. And kind of in Eli's case, it's also accumulating money, but it also accumulating, you know, notoriety and getting a bigger flock, so... And I guess I just find that less interesting than these other things that I've talked about where there's, like, cracks in the surface that I feel like I'm getting to know Plainview more. I don't feel like I get to know Plainview more in his interactions with Eli because it's just kind of like, yeah, he hates this guy who's annoying him. That's not interesting to me.
Well, it's interesting to me because it makes me wonder... Okay, why is it that he struggles so much to restrain his misanthropy with Eli than with so many other people? I think that the only other person who he is as openly hostile to on a consistent basis is the guy from, what is it? It's not Union Oil.
Standard Oil?
Standard Oil, yeah. And I think that it's because the guy from Standard Oil is successful and Plainview doesn't want him to be successful. And the same thing applies to Sunday, that Sunday is successful in his own way because he's managed to establish himself as a prophet. I don't think that what he is doing is what you would call orthodox Christian preaching. Like the whole thing about the third revelation, I'm not even 100% sure what that refers to. And doing these very theatrical, elaborate casting out of spirits is a thing in a lot of practices, but fairly fringe practices.
Yeah, you're not going to see it at a Protestant church.
Yeah, and probably. I think that especially for the time, Like, at this point, I think we're kind of in between the fire and brimstone paradigms. That there was one before this in, oh, I don't know, maybe like the 1800s, the early 1800s, and then there's going to be another one with, I can't remember his name, but some guy.
Come on, history guy.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's some dude who does something similar. It's not Billy Graham. Billy Graham was a little bit more laid back than that.
Yeah.
I don't know. But anyway. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Maybe I'm not even referring to anyone. Maybe I'm just making something up. Anyway, I think that, yeah. Well, yeah, I've said what I wanted to say, that Eli is successful in a way that, well, he's successful, and therefore Plainview hates him. And he's successful in a way that's harder for Plainview to undermine, because he can humiliate the guy from Standard Oil, or whatever it's called. I can't remember. Isn't it? Yeah,
Standard Oil.
Golly, Ned.
Wow, you are tired. We just established that.
Yeah, Standard Oil. But he can, like, outdo him as a businessman, but he can't really do that with Sunday. That he can't... he's not willing to. Obviously, he could, like, start his own church and try to become a preacher. He doesn't want to do that. And he can't win souls in the way that Sunday can, which is why I think that he relishes so much their final interaction, where he's able to just tear him down. And yeah, also, that's a great scene. I love that scene. Drainage. I drink your milkshake. I drink it up.
That was a pretty good impression. And yeah, he's doing a lot by the end of the movie.
The way he kind of, like, he just, like, ambles over. He's like, my straw reaches all the way over here.
Yeah, he does kind of look like Robbie Williams in A Better Man. Oscar-nominated Better Man. Doing that ape posture.
Oh my gosh. Can I just say, I had no idea that was supposed to be a real person. Or that, like, Robbie Williams is a real person.
That's most people. Apparently he, we're getting off track. But apparently he had a couple, like, famous failures to break into the American pop scene, and then this movie is just, like, further hammering home how, like, unsuccessful those attempts were, because yeah, everything I've seen is just Americans going, who on earth is that? I also have no idea who Robbie Williams is.
Why is he a monkey then?
Well, because it's, I have no idea. I've seen a lot of different theories.
He's not a monkey in real life?
No, he's not. He's a real human being. I've seen a lot of theories, and the most believable to me is that Robbie Williams wanted to play himself, and the director was like, well, you're clearly way older, so he made up some pretentious reason where he's like, you know, he's like a monkey because he had to be like a performing monkey as an artist or something. Anyway, so we're talking about There Will Be Blood. And yeah, I think that's a pretty good analysis. I don't know if it makes me like the movie much better, but I do think it is a very... I think it's interesting that, like, his only recourse at the end is he literally just beats Eli to death, right? That he can't beat him at any game. He can't be more religious than him, he can't win more souls, and so his only recourse is to just kill him. I think that's kind of interesting.
It's a metaphor for the secular god of capitalism destroying the old god of religion.
Wow, that's so potent. It's
scathing.
Isn't it in Parasite where they have, like, the rock and they keep saying, like, oh, it's so metaphorical. That's me.
Oh,
when
yeah.
I watched the end of this movie.
It's so metaphorical.
But no, I think that's all right. I still just think I don't know. I just don't think that's interesting enough to justify the runtime is something that really kind of I get hung up on for this movie. I think one of the other things I want to talk about is the technical elements of this movie. I especially found the opening of this film to be really engaging. There's no dialogue for probably the first, 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes. It's just like little vignettes showing plain view as he's getting started in some of this like oil industry and stuff. And it's just very compelling imagery of him, right, literally dragging himself with a broken leg, like miles to get some silver, like money from silver he's been mining. Like, that's a pretty potent, that's pretty metaphorical for what he's going to spend the rest of the movie doing, is dragging himself, kicking and screaming into wealth if he can. But I think the other thing that makes this opening really great, besides, like, obviously anytime that we're doing just visual storytelling, that's very compelling, but the soundtrack is so bizarre. And it's Johnny Greenwood, and Elliot, maybe you don't know this, but Johnny Greenwood is one of the guitarists for, I think he's the bass player for Radiohead, which is a band that I adore. I love Radiohead. I've seen Johnny Greenwood actually in concert before. Bit of a flex here. But I think the score is fascinating because it sounds so alien and so bizarre. And I think it does a really good job of kind of separating us from the story and making the story seem ominous and evil, even when it is just like Plainview doing something that could be construed as like a sick moment. I feel like if you compare this movie with Wolf of Wall Street, no one is watching There Will Be Blood and they're like, dude, I want to be like Daniel Plainview. Like, what a giga Chad awesome alpha.
Oh my gosh, I can't believe you and... just used that word.
But I mean, that's the verbiage of people who watch Wolf of Wall Street and go, dude, Jordan Belfort is sick. And I think There Will Be Blood does an amazing job of not ever letting you go, whoa, dude, yeah, Plainview really stuck it to that guy. And I think the soundtrack goes a big way towards doing, I mean, obviously the actions he takes and Daniel Day-Lewis's acting are also doing a good job. But the soundtrack is so consistently eerie and off-putting and alien in a way that, like, you're never going to get invested in Plainview's story and be like, yeah, dude, stick it to that Standard Oil guy. You're just like, ooh, yikes. That's not, like, oof. And I think that's so fantastic. I mean, the movie looks amazing, and I think the score is amazing because of that sort of quality to it.
Well, I agree. The soundtrack reminds me of the soundtrack for, like, Gone Girl or Spencer, in that it's very discordant. It's not necessarily pleasant to listen to, but what?
It's effective.
Yes. Yeah. It enhances what you're seeing on screen. And, of course, the movie, it looks fantastic. There's a lot of famous shots from the scene where the oil well catches fire, and the shot, it's like a shot of Plainview from the back, and it starts pulling out as he is motioning the teams of like bombers, I guess, into blow up the well and get it to stop. It is quite striking imagery. Also, like, oil's just an evil looking substance, isn't it? It's too thick to be watery, and it's pure black. It just looks bad.
Well, I'm not gonna recommend this movie because I don't think it has very much to do thematically, but I did think a lot about Werner Herzog has a documentary called Lessons in Darkness about the aftermath of the Kuwait War, where a lot of the movie is just like ambient noise set to people trying to put out oil fires with like very little dialogue or something. And it feels very similar to watching this movie, where it feels like you're watching aliens on an alien planet having to deal with some apocalyptic event. And this movie very much has again, the score feels alien and bizarre, and yeah, oil just looks awful. And when it's on fire, it looks like the earth is like, it looks like something out of Revelations, that you're like, oh, this is like the earth is erupting in flames. This is a problem, guys.
The book of Revelation is single.
Oh my bad. Gosh, dang it.
That's the oldest mistake in the book.
Yeah. What was the... There's some movie recent that, like...
Long Legs.
Yeah, it was Long Legs, yeah, where she's like, actually, it's just one revelation. Anyway.
Yeah, and the camera just holds on it, and everyone's like, what is that?
What? Yeah. No, that was true. But I've kept that in mind, because I've noticed other people saying revelations, and I'm like, oh, it's revelation. And then I just did it. What a hypocrite.
It's just the one. It's just the one revelation for the one guy. Maybe Werner Herzog would feel better about things if, instead of filming the guys trying to put out a fire, he helped them.
He's helping them by filming them. He's helping them by, like, magnifying their story.
Whatever. It's like in the commercials for animal shelters, when there's just, like, there's B-roll of pets in abominable circumstances, and you're like, why isn't the camera guy doing anything?
Yeah, I guess in Werner Herzog's defense, I'm pretty sure the people putting out these fires are like trained professional. It's not like, oh, it's a little fire. Like, it's a fairly serious affair. They're wearing like crazy suits and stuff.
I guess, yeah, there's not much he can do.
You should watch it.
What can you do but watch it burn, man?
So true. I think that's a line from the movie. Anyway. That's kind of all I have that's kind of most of my thoughts for this movie. Do you have any closing thoughts before we get to maybe a rating here?
No, I think I've said what needs to be said.
Yeah, so I think this is a classic, like 7 out of 10 movie for me, or maybe like more like a 7.2 out of 10 movie. It's really good. There's a lot of things in it that are really compelling, but it's also almost 3 hours of one guy that I don't necessarily find as interesting as someone like Citizen Kane, where I in our review of Citizen Kane, I just talked about how I think he's such a fascinating character who we're constantly seeing new, more interesting layers of, as well as that movie's only 2 hours long. This movie is 3 hours, and it doesn't really feel like I'm getting to know him better through it, or that I'm seeing different pieces of him, but for what is here, I find very interesting. I'm not miserable for a lot of this runtime, and so I think that's kind of a classic 7.2 out of 10 movie. It's not an 8 out of 10 where I'm like, wow, that was so much fun, I love it. And it's not terrible, so that's my rating.
Okay, then. I think this movie's great, and I think Daniel Plainview is a significantly more interesting character than Citizen Kane. And this is actually a better movie than Citizen Kane.
What?
But anyway, I think this movie is really good. It's a really great character study. I love the whole corruption of power and wealth and stuff. And on this watch, I was able to appreciate to a greater extent the role of Eli Sunday, and the way that he enhanced Daniel Plainview. Daniel Day-Lewis, what a guy. Retired now, so
no, his son's making a movie, and Daniel's coming back out of retirement for it.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Well, that's just really nice of him. And also, like, what a way to ensure your son's movie is a success, because, like, no, Daniel Day-Lewis, he's the kind of actor who gets butts in seats, especially for, like, coming out of retirement. It would be like if Stanley Kubrick came out of death to make a movie. Well, I guess that would be significantly more notable. It would be like if... Who's someone who's
okay,
retired?
All right. Elliot, what's your rating for this movie?
My rating is an A. I give
this
movie an A.
Oh, nice. All right. Well, my recommendation...
Jack Nicholson. It would be like if Jack Nicholson came out of retirement.
He is in retirement. That's true. Well, my recommendation for this movie, if you like this movie for some of its commentary on the American ideal of the American industrialist or the American businessman, I'm going to recommend The Founder, which is the story of the man who made McDonald's what it is today, I guess you could say. If you watch the movie, you know that he's not really necessarily the creator of McDonald's. And I think just like There Will Be Blood, it's really interesting to see someone use the American image to further their own motives to get further in the world. And this is also anchored by a really fantastic performance by Michael Keaton. I know he had recently won, either won an Oscar or been nominated for Birdman, but I think about... fairly often the final scene in this movie where he's reciting the story that he's created about McDonald's in the mirror, and it is just an amazing performance where you can see that he kind of feels bad about some of the stuff he did, but at the same time he's incredibly rich. So I think The Founder is, you know, maybe an underrated movie. I don't like when people throw around underrated too much, but I think The Founder is an example of a movie that deserves it. So I think if you've never seen it, definitely give it a watch.
Well, I wholeheartedly second this recommendation. I think that's a fantastic movie. I would say that the movie is under-talked about, maybe more than underrated.
Yeah.
Like, people don't... It wasn't disliked on release, but it's just not in the conversation still in the way that There Will Be Blood is still in the film conversation. And I think that that's not reflective of the movie's quality, which is very high.
Yeah.
My recommendation is going to be, if you like this movie for the corruption of power, for the portrait of a brilliant person who's also very bad with people and kind of destroys themselves in their journey for success, you will be well served by The Social Network, directed by David Fincher, penned by Aaron Sorkin, famous team up. This movie is everything that I just described. It's a movie about a person who doesn't really like or understand people, but he understands, I don't know, he has the kind of mind that is conducive to the creation of a social network.
Yeah.
So it's about the founding of Facebook and the conflicts that inevitably arise over ownership and who came up with what. So yeah, a fantastic movie. It's David Fincher's directing sensibilities plus Aaron Sorkin's dialogue, which I'm not always up for, but I think that it really works in this film. I also think that Life is Hard and Full of Disappointments. Actually, I know that Life is Hard and Full of Disappointments.
Yeah. Some of us experienced disappointment today when we saw the nominations for the Oscars, and we saw that Challengers didn't get any. Did it deserve any? I'll let you decide.
What?
Challengers was shut out. I saw a lot of people complaining about that.
Who cares?
Well, a lot of people like Challengers. I didn't think it was all that, but, you know, some people thought it was really good. Anyway... thanks so much for listening.
You didn't say if you second that recommendation or not.
Oh, absolutely. I said that's maybe my second favorite David Fincher movie of all time. I think that is an incredible movie. It's a Shakespearean movie. It's amazing. In terms of an American story, I think The Social Network is up there. Also, another fantastic score by Reznor and Ross, speaking of.
Oh, yeah.
I love that. I used to, this is a fun story, I would listen to Hand Covers Bruise, which is the music from, like, the opening of the movie when he's walking across. I'd listen to that all the time when I was walking across campus, and I'm like, I'm just like Zuckerberg. I'm going to, you know, I'm angry about my girlfriend, so I'm going to go create a misogynistic website.
Wow. I listen to Dance Macabre when I'm walking around, and I'm like, I'm just like Death playing the fiddle for all the skeletons. Dude, wow, we have funny. Gotten sidetracked in this episode.
Yeah, we should keep, you know, send us an email. Did you enjoy this episode more than usual? Should we always record deep into the night so that we're sleep deprived and given to going on tangents?
That would be a bad idea, because when I get really, like, really properly tired, I laugh at literally everything. Wow. So the entire episode would just be, you would say the most inane stuff, and I would just be busting a gut.
That's funny. But anyway, send us an email, you know, if you have a movie request, if you want our thoughts maybe more specifically on something in the Oscars, send us an email, let us know. The email's always in the description, both of the podcast and of this episode. We are going to be coming to you next week with a brand new review every week, always. I'd say 80% of the time that's going to happen. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you have a great week, and bye.